Yeah, so today, first of all, this year is going to be the Eli Nishmas Yosef Hirsch Ben Chaim, my mother-in-law's father. It's his yard site today, so we'll do this Eli Nishmato. So today we're going to examine again this concept of the sukkah, like yesterday, as this kind of vulnerable shelter. Right, as from a little different perspective, we're going to take a more existentialist perspective, as one that makes us sound smart when we say words like existentialist, and also because a lot of these thoughts were inspired by, and maybe even directly informed by, the work of Ernest Becker and his denial of death, which is, for sure, I think maybe. The deepest non-Torah book that I'm familiar with, which doesn't necessarily mean much. I just not be familiar with a lot of books. But good. The basic idea. Remember, we spoke about we talked about Rosh Hashanah. Is this idea that we need to be woken up. Right? And we said it's funny because we feel awake, right? As it's one thing where you have, you know, literally somebody sleeping and you wake them up. It's very clear what's taking place. But for us, I feel like I'm awake. That's what I have to wake up to. What exactly? And what does that process mean? So we go back to the Mesilas Yesharim. Now we're going back to the pre-Rosh Hashanah. What was going on that I needed to wake up from? That this whole process of the Rosh Hashanah, so it's a Yom Kippur thing, was a result of a new awakening. Awakening into what, or from what, exactly? That now I need to protect it. What is it that I'm protecting exactly? What is it exactly that happened that I'm now trying to protect? That's a question that needs to be answered. So we go back to Mesilas Yesharim. Mesilas Yesharim says that this world, he says, he brings Chazal compared to Laila, nighttime. It's compared to nighttime, and he says that there's two things that happen, there are two problems of being in the dark, right? Of being at nighttime in the dark. The two problems are, one, there's a lot of stuff you don't see, right? When it's dark and it's nighttime, you don't see a lot of stuff. You could fall right in a pit, you didn't see it, because it's dark. And he said, and the second thing, which he says is more problematic, the second thing is that you misinterpret what you do see, right? He said you see a pole, you think it's a person, right? You're constantly misinterpreting things as well. And he says that's what this world is like. So in your first read of that, or at least in my first read of that, the way I understood it is that those are errors that we're prone to in this world. As an experience in this world, these are mistakes that we're likely to make. And we lean in these directions, so to speak. That, well, there's lots of things that we won't see. And we'll also tend to misinterpret the things that we do see. Okay? And that those are errors that you should be aware of, that you're prone to. But, and think about it more, I think really that it's further than that. Now, I don't think these are errors that you're prone to here. I think it's a description of your experience here, okay? And I'm going to admit in advance, I don't know if this is what the Ramchal meant. I'm not claiming to be Mefarish the Ramchal. I believe very much that this is true. It may just be inspired by a Ramchal, okay? But it may also be what he means. I'm not sure. Because they don't start calling me out that if you look at the words, it's not really what he's saying. Okay, maybe it's not what he's saying, okay? But I feel it's hard to argue with the accuracy of the observation, which is that's all we ever do. It's not that we live in reality, but sometimes we don't see things and sometimes we misinterpret things. All we ever do is not see things and misinterpret things. Okay? That's all that ever happens here. First of all, in terms of not seeing things, that's easy. Right? I was looking it up the other day. How many people are there in the world? I'm somewhere between 8 and 9 billion now, okay? By the time you're listening to this more. How many people are you going to meet in your life? Okay, so a person, you live into your 90s, live about 30,000 days. Let's say you met 3 new people every day, okay? Which is not going to happen. But let's say it's 90,000 people out of 8 billion. That's a fraction of it. It's like 0.00075% or something. Okay? Nothing. Nothing of the available amount of people are you going to have any interaction with. And significant interactions, we're talking even a tinier fraction of a fraction of a percent. Okay? How many books are there? So you look it up, it's something like 200 million books, you know, in print, and just in the United States alone being printed another 300,000 a year, okay? Or I think it's maybe 500,000 now. How many books are you going to get to read in your life? Even if you read a new book every day, that's 30,000 books. Now, not counting your childhood when you didn't know how to read, okay? That's nothing. Also a fraction of a percent. How many songs are there? Okay, so a few years ago, they counted about 100 million songs. Again, the same problem. How many songs are you going to hear? How many books are you going to read? How many people are you going to meet? Nothing. Nothing. Not even a drop in the ocean, maybe literally. I don't know if you do the math. We're going to get to explain, even a person who is actively trying to expose themselves to what is available in this world, of meeting new people and traveling new places and reading new books and listening to new music and the whole thing, he'll only ever touch on a tiny fraction of what's available. It's incredible. It's impossible. It's legit physically impossible, the amount of time you have to taste any more, to get any more than my father-in-law said, any more than just a lick of what's available here. And now you start getting into how many thoughts are there to be thunk, right? Oh, it seems like an endless amount. How many thoughts of what percentage of the total number of thoughts that can be thunk are you going to think, okay? The number must be infinitesimal. It's crazy. So you're only ever going to think of a tiny fraction, you're going to experience a tiny fraction of what there is to experience. It's the experience of not experiencing is fundamental. It's not that we sometimes don't see things. You're not going to see the vast majority of what's going on. And if you want to get spiritual, right, and start talking about what's going on from a spiritual perspective, olamos and things and malachim and Lord, I don't know what that stuff is. You for sure have no consciousness of any of that. Okay? We're blind to the tiniest sliver of reality. Tiny. Tiny, frighteningly small amount of reality we're exposed to altogether. Okay? And so that's fact number one. Hard for me to say that that's an issue that we sometimes have. Okay? That's where we live. We live in point something percent of reality. Struggle as you might against it. And the second problem that Ramchal says is even worse is that even in our point whatever percent of reality, we misunderstand what we're looking at. Okay? And I don't think it's that we might misunderstand. I think it's that we do misunderstand. Okay? We misconstrue the very reality that we have. So in a simple sense, you know what I mean? It's like, how much of what you know are you really confident in? And how are you going to feel about that 10 years from now? Okay? So for sure, our understanding comes always deepening and changing. Okay? But I think no matter what, we're not really seeing what's going on. It's part of the same problem. It's really, because what's the problem at night? Why are you misinterpreting? Because you're not seeing it. Right? You're just partially not seeing it instead of all the way not seeing it. So there's certain things that B'chol don't even show up in our brains, okay, at all, on no level of experience. But other things are showing up, but we're only seeing part of them. Right? Why do you think the Amud is an Adam? Why do you think the pole is a person? Because you're seeing some things there, but you don't see enough of it to what do you call it, and so you interpret it incorrectly. So it's still a problem of not seeing. So it's in reality, there's things we interact with, but we don't see. We don't see implications of it. We don't see the significance of it. We don't really understand what's going on. I think, and the easiest place to see this is just, you know, human relationships. Other people. How much of the other people are you really seeing? Very little. Right? Even people that you would count as friends or even close friends. How much of their totality of who they are you really aware of? Okay, and as such, you misinterpret them. Right? Fact. You don't not see them at all. I mean, most people you don't see at all. But these people you're seeing, you're interacting with, you're having relationships with. But the person you're having a relationship with, you're misunderstanding. And it's not your fault. It's not because you're a bad person. It's just because we're stupid. By design. We're by design kept in the dark. And so you can only ever really relate to a fraction of the person that he is, or she. And since you're only looking at a fraction, you're by definition misinterpreting what you're looking at. Okay, that's just, and it's for everything. It's true for apple, eating an apple. It's true for every experience or anything you can have. since you're only experiencing a fraction of what it is that's going on, by definition, relating to a fraction of something is a different world than relating to the whole thing. Okay, that is, we're going to come back to that point and how to fix that as we go, okay? That's our situation here. Okay, and this was my initial approach to this, and like I said, whether it's what the Ramchal is trying to say or not, I don't think it's an undeniable truth about our situation here. So, but in recent exploration, I have discovered. Which is that we are involved in this process, okay? As opposed to looking at it that we're victims, which is for sure true. As opposed to looking at it purely that we're victims of our position here, of our living in the dark here in this world, of not seeing and of misinterpreting. We're not just victims; we're also kind of complicit in the act. We're into it, right? We also vote in favor of this limited reality, okay? And this is where the existentialist people step in, okay? There, the existentialists say as follows. You know what, let's use an example to kind of ground this in a reality we're all familiar with, hopefully. It may resonate with the boys more with the girls. I assume there's more boys than girls listening. Davening, okay? Davening is something that we live with on a daily basis, all of us. And davening comes with a whole bunch of rules. And the davening experience for your average person is something like this. You wake up 10 minutes late. You guys got to hustle. If you're going to be able to get him Sukkot Zimra before they hit Barku, you struggle, you get there, you get your tefillin on your thing. You're able to do Baruch Shem Asher Yishtabach. Right, quick before they say Baruch Hu, you know, you wipe your forehead, you got it. You get Baruch Hu, you're there for Birchas Kriya Shema. You do your thing. You say Kriya Shema. You said Kriya Shema slow. You didn't slur your words together, right? You said each word crisp and clear. Feeling like a winner, right? You head into Shemona Esrei. You have a decent Shemona Esrei, right? Maybe not the last one done, but you're not the first one done either. It was a nice solid Shemona Esrei. You had Perush Amilim. You were actually thinking about what you're saying. You didn't fall asleep and You didn't fall asleep and miss the whole middle section. Right, or jump right from, skip from Hashivenu to Hashiva Shoftenu, right? You just do the warp zone there and cut through that whole middle part. It's not Shabbos where you all of a sudden catch yourself at Slachlanu, right? You know, where you bang your chest for Slachlanu and then try to cover it by coughing or something, looking around, hope nobody caught you. Right, none of that happened. You were conscious, you were paying, oh, you're a winner. You're a winner, right? And you do your thing and you catch your Kaddish and your Ishmael Rabbas and your things and Alenu, whatever it is, right? You have a whole system and you're bowing at the right time, you're standing at the right time, sitting at the right time. You know, you're going to make sure you got Kriya Shema within Zman Kriya Shema. You're mugging a Vromnik or a Gronik, whatever it is. That's the world that Tefillah becomes for people. And now looking at, and it's a big world, Tefillah. Tefillah is a very deep thing. Right, the words, there's tons of concepts in there to think about, you know, bookshelves of books written as a parish of the tefillah. Pretty much actually all of our Ikar Emunah are contained within the tefillah somewhere. There's plenty to think about, and there's plenty of rules and laws to keep, and they're not easy. So the whole tefillah experience has plenty of room into it for successes and for failures and for you know, the full gamut of experience. But let's take a look for a second. At the Ramban. Okay, the Ramban talks about tefillah. The famous Ramban at the end of Parshas Bo, where he's also talking about the purpose of our existence, which he said, what do we do when we do tefillah? What's happening when we get together in Shul? Here's the activity. I'd boil down to a sentence in the Ramban. It's that we're all getting together to declare together publicly, so for all, that we've been created. That there's a creator, we're creations, and to give thanks to our creator for creating us. So, that's the activity of tefillah. Okay? And now, the question is, let's go back to your shul experience. Okay, how much is that was that what was going on, right? You caught Baruch Shem Rashi Yishtabach and you felt like a winner. Okay, so what? Right? How was that? And you legit feel good about yourself. Right? And you thought about Perush Milim and Shemona Esrei. Right? What's the difference between Slach Lanu and Machal Lanu? Right? You have your Chidushim and your thing. And I'm not trying to downplay it. All that stuff is valuable. But in thinking about the Ramban is discussing, what was that happening at all? And why not? We all know the Ramban, and if you didn't, you know it now. So say here's where the existentialists come in, okay? They're not talking about tefillah, but talking about life in general. Existentialists say like this: life, generally, is too much for people, okay? Life is legit just, it's overwhelming. Right? And specifically from their, as evidenced by the title of his book, specifically mortality is a big one, right? And as the fact that we're all gonna die is a reality. Our mortality is a reality that is overwhelming for your average person to deal with. And overwhelming meaning that we can't. Okay? You legit cannot handle that thought. And so what we do is, we don't think about it. Okay? We make sure not to think about that. For most people, the idea of their birth is also overwhelming, right? Because it means that there were times that you didn't exist. And also indicates a certain arbitrariness to your existence that you didn't have to be. Right, which is a little much for people to handle also. These are thoughts that, would we think about them, many of us would break down. Okay, lead straight into nervous breakdown land. Confronted with our own mortality, most of us could not handle that at all. And certainly we can't handle living with it on a daily basis. Right, living under the threat of death all the time. That's a recipe for making people crazy, and it does. And so how do we deal with that, though? How do we deal with our own createdness, right? The fact that we're created beings, that we came into existence at a certain point after non-existing, and the fact that we're going to die later on. How do we deal with these things? So what we do is we don't think about them. But how do you not think about them? Is you create a world for yourself that is smaller, that doesn't include those parts, but is rich and varied enough. It gives enough space for you to grow and develop and experience the full, quote-unquote, full range of experiences, of victory and failure, and there's room to grow and develop within this smaller structure that you built. And in that world, you don't ever have to pick your head up and think about these extremely difficult questions, okay? Yeah, take your average person. Look at his day. He wakes up, downstairs, eats breakfast, right? Reads the paper, he goes to work, comes back, he has his whole daily schedule, day after day, week after week. And even if you want to throw in our religious thing, you know, he has chakras and his things and his he's got a shir after work and he comes back and then he does Shabbos and he hits the mikvah and he goes to Shabbos and he has this special suit that he puts on and the foods and the stuff and he goes through his kids' Dvar Torah with them and they sing songs. And it's a whole world that doesn't ever involve any thoughts about his own mortality or purpose of existence or any of these things, but it doesn't need to. Here's the point. I construct a world where I don't need to think about those things. Why? Because my world is full. My world is complete, right? There's room for struggle and for challenge, right? For me to be able to be a good father, to be a good husband. These are challenging things, to keep waking up for the minyan, right? To go to that Daf Yomi Shir, even though I'm wiped out and had a miserable day, my boss is ripping into me all day at work. It's the last thing I want to do. But I drag myself over there to do it. Those are meaningful things. Those are valuable things. Those are difficult things. Those are things that challenge me and give me an opportunity to grow and develop as a human being, to feel the possibility of victory, the possibility of failure. I'll have sorrows and failures and setbacks, and I'll have victories and successes and excitement. I can have what seems to me to be a full range of human emotions and experiences, all within this world that I've built for myself, and because it's a self-contained, full world, so I don't need to go anywhere else. I don't need to think further than that into these more basic, all-encompassing questions about the purpose of my existence here and questioning my own mortality and what the heck I'm gonna do about that. Okay, I don't have to think about those things because my world is complete without them. There's nothing to drive me to those questions, and I'm happy about that, I'm saying. I'm happy because I don't want to think about those things. They're super scary. And not super scary in like a, what do you call it? Super scary like life-endingly scary, no pun intended, right? Like calling into question everything that I do, everything that I know about myself and my life, every decision that I've ever made, the whole structure of everything that I'm doing on a day-to-day basis, all of it called into questions by these questions, called into question by these questions. I will come apart. I will literally come apart. And so I cut them out. The picture that I have in my head is when you have dogs, okay? People own dogs. So dogs need to run around, okay? Or even, yeah. So they need a yard, but you want them to run away, okay? So you need a yard that's big enough to give them room to run around, right? But still fenced in so that they don't run away, okay? Or all those, the private game farms and stuff in Africa. Okay, I need a big enough space that these things can run through their life cycle. But I need fences so that they don't escape. Right? That's what everyone does. We all do. Every one of us has done that. We've built an enclosure for ourselves where there's enough room, hopefully, to move and shake and grow. But cut down to safe. In the interest of safety, of the safety and security of our shallower experiences, we do fence it in so that we don't head into any of those dangerous questions that would make everything, that would shake everything up. You know, and the problems occur for people when they err too far one way or the other way. Right? In other words, on the one side, if you make your enclosure too small, okay, and you make it oppressively confining, so you're very safe, but there's a very little room for movement and growth and development. Right? And these people are—it's a more depression, you know, kind of oriented world, where there's very little that you're allowed to do, and very little, few places you're allowed to go, and life becomes very rigid, and very unfree, and that's stifling to a person, and leads to all kinds of mental illness. On the flip side, if you make the enclosure too big, what starts to edge into these larger questions, it gets very hard to function. Because think about it, what does this world require of you? You know, a person needs to go to work. Right? You have to go into the office and sit down and do your thing. Right? Now, how are you going to do it? Because think about, you know, Chas Shalom, a person got informed by his doctor that he's got, you know, 6 weeks to live or whatever. So there's no way he's going to be able to do his work. He can't go in and function on almost any level. Not at work, not with his friends, not with anything. Hard for him to eat. So how come for us, we all got the death sentence. We all know we're going to die at some point. It's just far enough ahead that I don't have to think about it. And now I can go to work and spend my day doing superficial things involved in meaningless activities. Right? Because I'm living in a safe place where there is no death. Okay, when death becomes something of reality, so it interferes with my ability to function very severely. Okay? That's hard to enjoy the party. All right? I and Edgar Allan Poe. So that's the existentialists say that's the situation for every human being. And what he said, what Ernst Becker's conclusion is that it's the job of the mental health professionals to help people design healthy lies. Right? Help people design enclosures to live in that are healthy, that keep them safe from the questions that would destroy them, while at the same time giving them enough room to experience the full gamut of emotions and experiences. Okay? Which is, sad. What a sad thing to say. But there's no alternative because you obviously can't lock people down in full. Because that leads to severe depression and unhealthiness. But you can't expose them to reality. Because you'll destroy them. What are you going to do? You know, take down the fences? You've caged yourself in. Let's take down your fences and live in the real world. You put them in the real world and now they're crushed. The real world is overwhelmingly terrifying. And it'll be the end of them. Should have left the fences up. And so that's your job. Leave the fences up. Help them build the fences in a way where they can run around. Right? Like dogs in a yard. That's a pretty good muscle for it. Good. So what do we do? What's our perspective on this? Okay, because it's all true. Okay, none of their description is inaccurate. It is It's exactly what we do, and it's exactly where we live. So now what? And so, the truth is that we say things like, okay, once we have a religious system. So what Becker talks about is a religious system, and a God can help you deal with the death thing in such a way that you don't have to fence it off. Why? Because death is no death at all. I just read last night in the Dover Shalom, Perush on the Siddur, the Dover Shalom. He talks about it. We say in the second bracha of Shemoneh Esrei, Mei Misu Machaya, that death is not death. The death is only a stage in further life and in more life, in a lifier life. Okay, so that's one way to do it, but that handles the death problem. But the essential problem is still the same. Even if you have a belief in a religious system that lets you handle death, it doesn't really take care of the problem. Because first of all, I don't know that death is any less terrifying. Okay, from the even in its religious incarnation as just the end of this stage, I think that's still pretty terrifying. At least to me. And the truth is that the existence of God, let's even say that it's not, and I'm wrong, just because I'm not holding there. But the existence of God itself is terrifying. Right? Facing full on the fact that you're a created thing. Standing in front of your creator and recognizing that I'm a fictional character in somebody else's story, that I have no reality of my own, that I have no security and no stability and nothing that I can rely on. And that I exist fully with every detail of that existence dictated by the will of something that I can't control. And this God who answers to no, who's Kel Elyon, answers to no one and does whatever he wants with no repercussions. That is seriously terrifying. That's terrifying on a whole different level. That, in a certain sense, is more terrifying. Pulling the rug out from under you and your whole sense of self and everything that you know. That is a new terror, so to speak, that I think overshadows even that of death, for sure for us. And so now the Ramban is asking you to go to Shul and have that experience? That's what's supposed to happen at Shul. Let's go to Shul and I'll stand and realize that I don't exist in the way that I like to think of, that I have no safety and no security and nothing to rely on except for God, and all I have to rely on is God's kindness, and that even God, I can't twist his arm. And I can't force him or appeal to anyone. There's no manager to speak to. I can't ask to speak to his manager if I don't like how he's treating me. That I'm 100% at Hashem's mercy to do with as he pleases. That is, to recognize I'm a creature is terrifying. It's terrifyingly difficult to do that. Right? Of course, and afterwards, the gratitude that would come if you could have that recognition would be overwhelming. You'd be, like Rabbi Green says, a puddle on the floor of gratitude, and absolutely enslaved, full-on slavery. Eved Hashem then would become absolutely literal to you. The level of responsibility that comes with, and how you're going to have to rewrite your whole life just from that one realization, is it's too much to ask. It seems too much to ask of a human being. And so instead, we go to Shul, and we take davening, and we cut it down to a manageable size. Where now it's about timings, now it's about getting certain things said, now it's about at best thinking about certain ideas. And it is also about that. But that's the part of it that I'll look at and I'll blind myself, fence off the difficult parts, and misinterpret the parts that I'm relating to, because this is a smaller world that I can handle. Because as a small person, I need my world to be smaller. Okay? And just like it's true that living in a small world makes you smaller, it also is true that as a small person, I need my world to be smaller. I can't handle the big thing. If I went to Shul and had that experience, it'd be over. I'd be in a mental hospital. But now what? Okay? Now what? So what do you do? So what's the message here? How does this connect to anything? So we spoke about, back by Rosh Hashanah, this idea of waking up. What are we waking up to? We're moving the fences a little bit. Look at Chazal. Think about where you come from, right? Think about that you're just a product of a putrid drop, right? Think about that you're going to end up rotting in the ground. Think about the fact that you're standing din v'cheshbon before your creator. All of those thoughts are showstoppers. Every one of those thoughts will destroy you if you try to step right from here to there, okay? The Chazal are like, think about them all. Think about it. Bring them into your consciousness. They want you to move the fences. Maybe even remove the fences. Okay, but how? How? And that doesn't seem like a good idea, like the existentialist said. It doesn't seem like a good plan. I don't know how functional I'm going to be. Cosmic responsibility? Am I going to be able to get up and go to work with that? Hanging around my neck? My own mortality? The seeming arbitrariness of my own existence? I don't know. I don't know. If you fully understood that you're a fictional character, I don't know how to say it better, that you're a character in a story that you're not telling, to the extent that we have legit Rishonim and Gaonim who hold that you have no free will, that your whole experience of choice and everything is an illusion. Real people, rabbis, Gaonim. And the Chovas brings them and can't even, and says, we just don't know it. Maybe they're right. That thought would destroy you. How are you going to do anything? So what do we do? Because on the flip side, I don't want to stay locked down forever. And we're talking about Rosh Hashanah waking up is you can move in the fences a little bit. Moving them out a little broader. My enclosure is a little bigger. I'm moving the fences out a little bit to include more of Riyah than it was before, which means now that I'm seeing more, I'm going to be seeing more, which means I also will be interpreting things a little more correctly than I was before. Will it be perfect? No, because by definition, this world, I can't. But it'll be better. Movement towards clarity on my situation here in a big way of what's happening. So now we're talking about Sukkot. I need to protect that. I want to protect that process. I don't want to protect the particular revelation that I had necessarily. I do, like we spoke about yesterday. Of course I do. But I want to protect the movement of it. You hear the difference? In other words, I made a movement and I have an endless amount of movement ahead of me. Okay? I have an endless space to move these fences back. And I gained a few inches. I pushed them out a few inches. I want to protect that process. I want to continue that process endlessly of my life growing bigger and my world getting bigger and bigger, including more and more of what it is that's going on. As big and scary and terrifying as those thoughts seem here, I want to move towards them, to a world where I can handle them. Okay? That's what I want. And that is the lesson of the Sukkah. There's a very weird Gemara that talks about those three gates to Gehenna. This is brought by the Maharal. Moshe Shapiro brings it in a discussion about Sukkot. I don't know where the Maharal stops and he starts. I don't know. But the Gemara says in Erevin that there's three gates to Gehenna, three gates to hell. One in the sea, one in the desert, and one in Yerushalayim. Okay, so we're not going to do the whole thing because I don't understand it and it's also not relevant to our point. But the one in Yerushalayim, he says interestingly, Yerushalayim to Chazal was the symbol of civilization. Okay, it was the most civilized city that ever was. Yerushalayim is the symbol of society, of civilization. So one of the gates to hell is there. So Jean-Paul Sartre is already, you know, laughing. You know, hell being other people, of course that makes sense. But in our perspective, what that means is that society is the world, is the smaller world that we've built as humans to live in, let's say, for us. Okay, that's what society is. That's what a civilization is. It's a small self-contained world with plenty of room for growth and development and success and failure and pain and pleasure and everything. Right? That's the world that humans built that they're comfortable living in. And that's the gate to Gehenna. If you get stuck there, that's right, that's an absolute failure. So I don't want to get stuck there. Okay? So how do I do it? How do I fix the problem? And that's the symbol of the Sukkah then is going to be the maneuver of how to live in such a way that I am addressing this issue. Which is, like we said yesterday, the Sukkah is a terrible protector, okay? It, by design, must not protect you. If you look in the halachas of the Schach, so the din of Shulchan Aruch and Mishnah Berurah is that lechatchila, you need to be able to see the stars. You should see the stars. But the evidence, as long as the rain gets through, you're okay. Okay, once the rain doesn't get through, you have people who are going to puzzle it. So these two things, the stars and the rain, I wanted to say, are really two different points of what it is that you're trying to let in. In other words, you're going to build a structure. That's the Sukkah. Okay, build structure for yourself. Build an enclosure. Okay? We don't have a choice about that. But you got to leave it open. You got to leave room for more. And now, so what somebody told me now, if you understand, Eibershitz actually says befeirs, but the stars are, he links to Yiras HaRoumimus, which means, what are the stars? really. Have you ever had a full consciousness of the stars? Probably not, because you just say they're stars and you move on. Ooh, there's so the most excited you ever gotten about stars was that there's so many of them, right? If it's particularly dark or whatever. Oh, so many. Wow, so many stars. But real consciousness of stars is what? Is an incredibly vast universe where you're not even a tiny speck on a tiny speck in the middle of nowhere, floating in the middle of nothing. Okay? That's overwhelming thoughts in the sense of awe, what we call Yiras HaRoamimus. Okay, an awesomeness of Hashem, Midas Nora, which they link to Sukkah, you know, but those are crushingly overwhelming thoughts for us. So if you can, that's the lechachila of our lives, to leave room for that awe, that overwhelming awe to make its way in to your life. But not everybody can handle that. Okay, and we talk about Yiras HaRoamimus, if you look into the Sifrei Musar, as like a second stage. You have to develop towards Yiras HaRoamimus. So the reason why that is, it's not like video game levels where you have to beat level 1 to get to level 2. It's that you have to be the kind of person that can handle those thoughts. Standing before the vastness of reality and surviving and being able to continue to function and do your job, that you have to be somebody very solidly worked out to be able to do that. You can't just step into that. There was a famous book series, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I think it was in this one, from Douglas Adams, where they had this booth that they put you in where you face the infinity of the universe. And it destroys you, basically. That's the... So that's what it would be, right? Faced with the infinity of the universe, it's just Hashem's creation, right? And the implications then about the God that made me, we would be crushed. Yiras HaRoamimus, you have to be a developed human being to be able to handle. And so the lesser level, but the avid level is, but minimally you have to let the rain in. And I'm going to link this to Yiras HaOnesh, means you have to recognize vulnerability. The minimal requirement is that you have to be vulnerable. Don't build a world that's safe. Don't build an absolutely safe world where you can't be forced out of it. Okay, the rain comes and we're forced out of the sukkah. The idea is that build a world where you're vulnerable to failure, where you're vulnerable to the extent that this world could come apart on you, that you might have to abandon ship on where you are. We've spoken about this before in terms of the idea of tents and things, but here this idea that I'm in a shelter that may fail me, that's the minimal consciousness that we need to have to survive. Anything more than that is possible. Build a fully secure universe for yourself. Build a cage for yourself to live in that's fully secure, and you'll never make it out. Now that's Gehenna. Get lost in a fully secure world with room for you to run and play with the other doggies, and it's over. Your life is over. That's the end of you. You have to leave room for a lack of safety, a lack of security. You have to maintain some consciousness of your own vulnerability and the vulnerability of your worldview, that it's too small for you, that there are fences that need to be moved, and that the rain could come in and kick you out of here. Then you have to maintain some consciousness. If you could, so open it up to a larger consciousness, if you can handle it. But if you can't, minimally, make sure you lack safety. So now, it's a crazy thing to say. I a friend who was working in business, and he, business works differently than regular 9-to-5. 9-to-5 job, not anymore, but once upon a time, you had such a thing as job security. You know, he had a 9-to-5 job, and he got a certain salary, and that was it. And he had a pension plan and a thing. And he said, by him, it's business, it's deals. It's business deals and things going through or not. And it's not a steady paycheck of any kind. He runs his own company. And he said he said it leaves room for Hashem in the picture. The lack of security that he had leaves room for Hashem. And it was very deep what he said. And very true. And it's exactly the point we're making. It left room for Hashem because it left room for failure. It was an insecure picture. That's what I'm saying. It's exactly the point that we made yesterday, but from a different perspective. Actually, that the whole worldview that you build, your whole home of where you live and where you are, needs to be insecure. You need to design it in a way where there's insecurity, because you need to recognize that whatever world you've built is incorrect. Whatever world you built is minimally too small and probably being and also being misinterpreted. That the fences are there and that they need to be pushed back. Leave room for something to come in that'll force you to rethink everything. All right, this goes back to our discussion on Pesach and She'ilas Tam. To be asking all the time, what is this? What is this? What is it that's going on? What is it that's really happening? To maintain that kind of thing, to maintain a vulnerability that I may have to redo all of this. I may have to redo the whole thing. It's hard, it's not easy. We spoke about before, the guys who, in the olden days of Birkas HaTorah, when we had older people that would come to the yeshiva, so they, you know, many of them realized they woke up at retirement age in their 50s and 60s, and they realized that they had never really pursued what it meant to be Jewish. And they knew there's this whole Jewish tradition and things that they were meant to inherit, and they didn't know anything about it. They didn't know Hebrew, they didn't know anything about the Torah, anything. And they're like, wow, I gotta go find it, I gotta figure this stuff out. And they came to yeshiva with nothing, saying, come teach me. And I said, it was so simultaneously inspiring and heartbreaking that that's possible. Don't do that. Is the lesson here. Okay, don't build a world that's that secure. Be ready to pack up. Go somewhere else. You know how challenging a thing that is? You know how incredibly difficult the task is that we're being asked to do now? That I have to be willing to rethink all the decisions that I've made? My job, my marriage, my relationship with my kids, my daily schedule, the way I think about things, the way I relate to self and everything, to question that continuously, to leave room for that vulnerability that I might be wrong about everything. Just that, even the minimal requirement, saying, but what's your alternative, really, is the point here. What's your alternative? To build a world that's safe and dead? To build a world, to build a yard to run around in that'll never grow and never expand and never come to include things like awe? That you're never going to be come face to face with your own mortality or your own insignificance in the face of your Creator? Or your own significance in your Creator's eyes? That you're never going to have any of those overwhelming feelings? Because the world that you built for yourself is safe and small and secure? Is it worth the price? Is it worth it for that illusion of security that you have? Right? So Chazal telling you, but of course not. Of course not. And of course it's worth any price that we'd have to pay. And even if I have to rip my whole life out from the roots and redo the whole thing, okay, I'm willing to do that. For if that's the price of living in a world, living in reality, and living in a world with a God. Okay, that's what's being asked, and that's, oddly, it's just a reworking of yesterday's idea. That's the security that I have. How am I going to be secure, not in the particular gains that I made like yesterday, but how am I going to be secure in this movement? How am I going to make sure that I don't go back to sleep? Not that I'll reverse back and backtrack, backslide, into my previous self before all this work that I did, like we spoke about yesterday. No, but how do I make sure I don't go back to sleep in the new one? I did it, I moved the fences. My world's a little bigger, my awareness is a little clearer than it was before, but I don't want to go to sleep in this one like I did in the other one and have to get woken up again next year. I want to stay awake. I want to keep pushing against those boundaries, keep broadening my world and making it bigger and full of bigger feelings and bigger experiences and full of more God. How do I make sure that happens? That's the lesson of the sukkah now. Is that, guess what? The only way to ensure that you stay there is to recognize that there is no real security here. To make sure you build your life consciously, that you stay conscious of the fact that you're vulnerable, meaning not vulnerable to the forces of evil in the world we spoke about, that you're vulnerable because the structure that you've built is by design, is by definition faulty. That the world that you've built for yourself is by definition illusionary. And that it needs to be adjusted. And remember that. Keep that consciousness all the time. And that'll keep you awake and alive and moving and changing. That willingness to redo everything is what you need to maintain in order to stay awake. And not fall back asleep in just a slightly larger enclosure. Shabbat everyone, and good Moed.